Proverbs 18, verse 1. A man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all sound or wise judgment. A man who isolates himself. Now, there's a Hebrew construction here. It's a little bit difficult. In many respects, the idea in the Bible about separating yourself is good. Most of the time, you're separating yourself from things that are bad, bad influences, bad people. The Lord says, come out from among them and be separate. And the Pharisees, of course, took this to an extreme, and they separated themselves completely and isolated themselves in their little communities and kept to themselves. But here in this context, there is a positive aspect put on this, although the King James Version still keeps the negative part. Here, the aspect is a man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. In other words, that he is going against sound counsel to be isolated to that point. Here's a person who purposely isolates himself. Now, there are those who are isolated for lack of finding friends. And I certainly can relate with the pain of that. It's a difficult thing, especially if you're new to the church. And maybe because of certain circumstances that you've found yourself here, and maybe you've moved into the area, or maybe another situation didn't work out, and you know, just it seemed to be dead, and you've found an exciting fellowship here, you're excited about the word and the worship, but you're still in that in-between spot where you haven't clicked with anyone yet. I met a couple about a month ago who they've been coming for 5 years, and they said, you know, we really still haven't clicked. And I was thinking, 5 years? 5 years is a long time. I mean, there's many reasons a person will come to a church, but there's only one that helps them keep plugged in, and that is if they find their niche. They find friends, and they get plugged in that respect. My struggle when I first went to from Michigan to California, I was in the church for about a year, and it was just one of those real tough, lonely times. You know, I'm a Midwest guy in California. I think my humor just fell like a lead balloon. And, of course, I know you probably think it falls like a lead balloon anyway. But it was just a tough, tough time in my life and not having any friend. And I remember the week in which a guy from the church began to work with me on my job. And we became good friends. And I'll tell you, just the burden that was lifted, having another friend. Friendship is a very important thing. But here is a person who purposely isolates themselves. There are those times when it happens, but here is one who's purposely isolating. Now, the Bible says we should not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25. And of course, the early church, when you look at it, was all about that Greek word koinonia, which is that rich sharing and fellowship and all things in common and understanding of each other. There's something very, very sweet when that happens. And what we're going to find, though, is that in many respects, a lot of that comes from the Lord. For example, if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. It's like walking in the light with Him is the foundation to have that enjoyment with each other. So here's a man who isolates himself. And perhaps he doesn't want to hear from anyone else, or he doesn't want to hear anybody else's counsel. He doesn't want to get close enough, or will only listen to a distinguished person that he perceives as more important than him. And there are people like that. They only want to talk to the head honcho. They only want to talk to the most important person because they perceive themselves, I don't want to waste any time with anybody else. And that's a bad thing. It really is, because we need to learn how to receive from anyone. We need to learn how to be open to those relationships the Lord might have for us and put in our path. And people that were maybe challenged to even to be around. We've already seen the definition of friendship in Proverbs 17:17, where he says, a friend loves at all times. This is a good definition. Here's a friend. One that loves at all times. Not a fair weather friend, which is really not a true friend at all. They're just fluttering around for the prosperous and the popular, constantly looking for a better opportunity. You know, they're just looking for a better way. And you know the people that when they're talking to you, they're always looking over your shoulder to see who else to talk with. That's not the type of friendship he's referring to. There's nothing more valuable than having a strong friendship. There's nothing more hurtful than having a shallow friend who betrays you. So you're going to be challenged in this. But to isolate yourself, this is a challenge right now in our society. Many people are doing this. It's so much easier just to go home and turn the TV on, and you have a constant companion there, packaged sleep. And you don't have to think. You don't have to, you know, try to work at any relationship. You don't have to try to be anything. And it's a very easy way. And a lot of people are doing this. They're hiding from reality. And we need to not isolate ourselves, but all the more get involved, get plugged in, work through things with people. A fool has no delight in understanding, but in expressing his own heart. Now remember, the definition of a fool is one who says in his heart there is no God. So here is one who has no room for God in his life. And consequently, you see, he doesn't really see any purpose other than what he wants himself. So naturally, he has no delight in understanding. He's not gonna be willing to take the time to listen to somebody else or hear from somebody else. He's not going to spend the time and energy to get to know somebody else. He's just interested in expressing his own heart and his own mind. Have you ever heard people talk, perhaps in a restaurant, maybe a little eavesdropping in one of the business men's conversations, or anyone in general? It's kind of funny when you think about it, because a lot of people really aren't listening to each other. They're talking, but they're not listening. You know, you'll hear a businessman say, "Hey, you know, we went out hunting last week, and you know, I saw this deer come under me, and then as I was leaning forward, this branch on the tree kind of cracked, and I thought it was going to fall." And another guy says, "You know, speaking about cracking branches, you know, I had a branch in our backyard that looked like it was going to fall on the house, and I had to get up there with a chainsaw. Oh, my brother owns a chainsaw, you know." Now, what's happening in this conversation? They're really not listening to each other. They're just keying in on one little phrase that they can begin to talk about what they want to talk about. Do you know a lot of us do this? You know, we're really not spending the time to understand and listen. We just are looking for opportunities to express ourselves. And in conversation, this happens. You know, a fool is delighted with what he already knows. He doesn't want to learn anything else. He just wants to share what he knows. Verse 3, when the wicked comes, contempt comes also, and with dishonor comes reproach. You know, we look at ourselves quite differently without the objectivity of others, you know. We think we're pretty cool, we think we're pretty happening, and everything's normal, and yet, you know, we may not see our motives or ourselves more clearly, and sometimes an objective friend can help us see. But when we don't have that, you know, you get this idea of the wicked coming, he's bent on himself, and eventually contempt comes. Now, we don't want to end up in contempt. We don't want to end up with dishonor and reproach. But that's where often that self-life leads. That's where it eventually ends up. We would have never planned it that way. And I have to think, you know, in context, if we had those friends around us that were true friends, we wouldn't end up that direction. You know, you'd have someone there to kind of stop your, you know, direction from going down the wrong road. I had friends in high school. You know, I was pretty crazy in high school, just with, because I guess maybe I wanted attention. I wanted to do some crazy thing, and I remember doing some really nuts things. Thanks to the Lord, I had some friends that would say, no, we can't let you do that. No, I can do it. Watch me. No, we're not going to let you do that. And I'd walk on my hands across the dam, you know, a concrete dam, and if I fell, I would have been dead. But I just to do it, you know, I can do it. And thank God I had friends, because I would be dead if I didn't. Verse 4, words of a man's mouth are deep waters. A wellspring of wisdom is a flowing brook. You know, the amazing things you can learn from others when you humble yourself, especially if you're new at walking with the Lord. You need to become a learner, a disciple, one who's listening to what others have to say. And because there are people that have walked in the Lord a long time, and they can give you some wisdom and counsel. Now, the funny thing is, I love this balance here, because you've got this, words of a man's mouth are deep waters. There's things that can be shared that a person has learned in their life, and God gives us the medium of words to communicate. But I think about an older Christian and a younger Christian. A younger Christian's zealous, but they lack knowledge. An older Christian can sometimes get lukewarm, but they have a lot of knowledge. It's a great thing to put older and younger Christians together. You know, because now you've got the older Christian who's going to get fired up with the zeal of the younger Christian. I love being around younger, zealous people that just, they want to serve the Lord. They're excited. Because I don't want to get stale. If I just hang around older Christians all the time, we can all just be stale, and we can all think that we're all fine, even though we're just lukewarm. But then you get the younger Christian, they need to get around older Christians. They need to learn that wisdom and that balance and that understanding. Now, you don't want to lose that zeal, but you want to gain some wisdom. So it's a perfect balance of getting people together. And again, maybe people we wouldn't necessarily choose. It is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment. Now, why would you do this? Well, the only motive would be selfish. You're going to get something out of it. You're thinking in terms of how this is going to work out for you. So you're going to show partiality to someone, or you're going to overthrow righteous judgment. It's only because it's selfishly motivated. Verse 6 says, a fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calls for blows. You know, he's just wrapped up in himself, and he's going to say thoughtless things. You know what a thoughtless saying is, or someone that says something very thoughtless to you. They didn't really think of how that was going to affect your feelings. They just said it. And you want to hit them because they said that. You know, it calls for blows. A fool's mouth is just, I think of a brawl in a bar too, you know, with a little alcohol getting in the blood. And you start to loosen up a little bit and your words start flying. You think you're really clever until someone smacks you one. A fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul. Amazing. Your own words become a snare to you. Because again, the fool speaks all that's on his mind. He's not interested in understanding, but just in expressing himself. So eventually he's going to stumble over his words, and it's going to cause to be a snare. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body. You know, I think this is a very interesting picture. It's a word picture of slander and accusation and what that means to people. It's called a tasty trifle here. Going down in the inmost body. Now, why are we so attracted to knowing about somebody else's failure? Why do we want to know? What is it in our flesh that gets delight in hearing about somebody else's foible or problem? You know, I think it all comes back to the self, but we've got to understand that when we hear things, that it goes right down to the inmost being. These secret things that we shouldn't even know. And, you know, I think it's an important thing to understand that we've got to deal with talebearers. The Bible gives us a strong picture of what talebearers or slanderers or whisperers mean. We need to avoid them. We need to set the record straight. One of the ways you can do that is ask them, can I quote you on that information? A talebearer is not going to want to be quoted. When they're giving you some juicy information about somebody, they don't want their name to be on the quotation list. You could also ask them this: have you talked to that person individually? Why are you telling me this? Why do I need to know this? There's a number of ways that you could put a stop to this, but the problem is there are so many talebearers because there are so many willing ears. If you stop the demand for it, the supply would stop. So you may not see everyone controlling their tongue, but you can choose what you're going to listen to. And I think there's a very important rule there. Now, of course, if it's not on a need-to-know basis, there are some things that are a need-to-know basis. If you're overseeing a ministry and someone in that ministry does some scandalous thing, that's a need-to-know basis. You know, if someone is in this church and they're in leadership, I need to know as a pastor, and I'd want to know. But at the same time, there's a lot of people on a not need-to-know basis, except for just curiosity. And I think in those cases, it's like you've got to let it go. You know, rumors fly all the time. It's amazing how many rumors start about various things and people and issues. And they always come back to me, and I'm always amazed how things just, how in the world would someone get that out of that? But they do, you know, just because talk goes around. Don't be a talebearer, but better yet, don't be a listener to talebearer. Don't increase or continue the supply of this. He who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. For lack of maintenance, things deteriorate. If you go out on one of these country roads and you see a barn or a building dilapidated and falling down, and you wonder, I wonder what happened to that building. I can tell you what happened to the building, most likely. Nothing. That's why it's falling down. Because nothing happened to it. Over time, things deteriorate. And I think very true in the area of work. You know, if you're slothful in your work, you're gonna eventually come to ruin. You're gonna come to emptiness. if you're not taking the time to invest what is needful in an area, then you're going to find one day you have a lack. But you know, I think you can also apply this to relationships. For lack of maintenance, relationships deteriorate. But you see, we're lazy in that respect, aren't we? So when we think of friends, we think of, you know, people that can just make it easy on our lives, and we can be lazy and not grow. No, we need to have friends around us that challenge us and move us on. We don't want friends that are like a comfortable old sock that we can just be ourselves and not grow and mature. We have friends who will challenge us. But those types of friends require some maintenance. It requires some choices that we make to get out, to turn the TV off and call somebody up and get together and pray with each other or do something productive. Go share your faith. Sign up in one of the ministries. Be challenged. Because this is the way we're going to grow. To do nothing, you're a brother to those who are a great destroyer. Because you will influence people's lives for the negative. I think of the impact that you could have on someone with your words and with your encouragement, and how without that impact, what decisions another person will make. I read a story about a young man who was coming home from school with all of his books, and another guy noticed him carrying all his books home for the weekend and couldn't understand why. Then he saw a bunch of other guys come by and push this young man down, and he fell and dropped his books, and the other guy felt compassion for him, so he went over and helped him up and says, you know, all those guys are just jerks. Don't worry about them. And the young man said, thanks. And they developed a friendship. He didn't see the guy before because he just moved from another school. And so now they were, you know, developing a friendship, and all through high school and all through college they were friends. Till the opportunity came where this man was going to give the speech at his college as they was graduating. And he told a story about what a friend can mean. And how that day he was leaving school with his books, he was planning on killing himself. Until that other man came into his life and became a friend. You know, and I think that guy could have made a choice, say, I'm not going to get involved with that, and went the other way. How much destruction comes from us doing nothing? We'll not know, because it'll never be in the statistics. You know, other things are in the statistics. A person does this and this happens. You can put that in the statistics, but you can't compile anything about all the things that are destroyed and ruined because of people doing nothing. And much more in relationships. The name of the Lord is a strong tower, and the righteous run into it and are safe. But a rich man's wealth is a strong city, and like a high wall in his own esteem. Here are contrasting fortresses here. God or money. Can't serve both. One is a safeguard. In reality, the other only seems to be a safeguard. It is in his own esteem, his wealth is like a high wall. But one who has come to know the true and living God, know that he is truly a strong tower, a refuge. And a tower in those days was a particular structure in the town that was the last refuge for people under attack. You know, if the enemy got in over the moat, and climbed the wall, got through the second wall, got through the first, you know, and second attacks or defenses. They finally come to this last tower, this remaining tower, which was doubled walled and tall and impenetrable. And sometimes people could live in that tower even if their city was taken. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The name of the Lord is his character, his nature, who he is. It's not just that his name is a magical word. If you use his name, it's going to be magical. In that culture, a person was named with meaning. When Esau was named, it was because he was hairy all over his body when he was born. They called him Hairy in Esau. When Jacob was born, he grabbed his brother's heel catcher. They called him Yaakov, heel catcher. Isaac. When Sarah found out she was pregnant, she laughed. They named him Laughter, Isaac. There's a meaning attached. Well, the name of the Lord is a meaning of all of his character and his nature. And he's a strong tower when you know him. The more you know him, the more safeguarded you are from this world because you know whom you believed. Verse 12 says, before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. Before honor is humility. You know, pride goes before the fall. And there's no room for pride in relationships. Because when you're stuck on yourself, it's very difficult to have others around you that are going to be faithful. So naturally, you're going to be on your own, you're going to be isolated, and eventually you're going to stumble with pride. But you know, here's the proud man. He thinks himself above the rest. So he doesn't waste time with other people. But before honor is humility. A humble man is looking for help. And he understands he has needs. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a folly and a shame to him. Now, have you ever had someone you start to say something and they assume they know, they figured out what you're trying to say, and they answer something totally different than what you were trying to say? That's in a communication scale, but this goes a little deeper than that. I mean, I sometimes have fun if I'm starting to say something to one of the staff or my wife, and I hear, and they kind of already think they know what I'm going to say, and so they start going on and on and on about another situation. I just let them go on. And at the end, I say, "That's very nice, but this is what I was trying to say." Kind of adds to the effect a little bit. But this is more than that. This is a little bit more than that. Here's a person who's prejudging a situation. He's made his mind up before he hears all the facts, before he hears both sides. Now, we're going to tie that into verse 17, so I'll wait till we get there, and then you can see how verse 17, which is pleading your cause and it seems right until your neighbor comes and examines. But notice this, verse 14, "The spirit of a man will sustain him in sickness, but who can bear a broken spirit?" We already looked at how a merry heart does good like medicine. And here is the spirit of a man sustaining him in sickness. But a broken spirit, who can bear? You know, if you lose hope, it's very difficult to overcome a particular ailment or difficulty. When you lose hope, it's very difficult to go on. There are more people suffering with depression in our society than ever before. It's a rampant, common thing in many people's lives, and many people are on drugs as a result of it, just because of that sense of hopelessness. I would encourage you, find your hope in the Lord. See your doctor if you're on already prescription medication to see if you can't reduce it according to, following his guidance, of course. But come to that place where you can find the Lord take the place of that. Keep your heart and mind. But there are many organic issues in a person's mind that would require certain chemicals to keep them balanced, lest they would totally go off. So there's certainly that understanding. But here, what a difference. A spirit of a man will sustain him. Having that hopefulness and having that plugged-inness to the Lord. The heart of the prudent acquires knowledge. The ear of the wise seeks knowledge. Again, putting yourself in that position where you can receive from someone else. A man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. Now, when I first read this, it sounded very similar to the other one where we're talking about the idea of a present, and giving a present, and we looked at that word as a bribe. This word, however, is not. This is actually a positive thing that's being expressed. A man's gift makes room for him and he brings him before great men. Why is it in this context? Well, this is similar in what we might consider in giving a thoughtful gift or card to someone to just boost them up or build them up or maybe restore a relationship. You know, maybe the idea of giving flowers when you know, guys, you've said something that's been a little bit rude to your wife and, you have a thoughtful card to encourage her or some flowers. It's more than just that. It's a gift that makes room and brings you before great men. The idea of Esau and receiving that gift from Jacob when he was after Esau, it soothed Esau's heart and mind. When I see Abigail bringing that gift before David, it eased attention. You know what? I think it's a very wise thing. There might be some people you're already on the outs with, you're having difficulty with, or you just would rather avoid and just go on. And of course, in our day and age, we can do that. We've got options. You know, we've got transportation. 100 years ago, you pretty much would have to make it do with the people you lived in that community. And you had to work through things. Nowadays, if something doesn't work out here, we can just drive over to somebody else's house. We can make any number of friends, in our area, or we can go out of the area. Problem is, we don't work at relationships. Here's a man who is thoughtful enough to work on it. You know, maybe there's somebody that he's on the outs with, and he's sending a gift and an encouragement and a word and saying, "Hey, let's bury the hatchet. Let's work it out." Here's just a thoughtful gift. Can you imagine what that would do? Think of somebody you're on the outs with right now. You're not on speaking terms. You just rather avoid each other. How about sending them a thoughtful card? maybe even if the Lord so inclines you to enclose a certificate for a restaurant, they can go out to eat with their wife. And encourage them and say, you know what, I just was thinking about you, and I don't like to have this tension between us when we kind of glance at each other at church and we don't want to talk because of a situation. That situation isn't important enough for me to let our relationship be ruined over whatever it was. And you know, I'll tell you what a bridge that would build. Imagine. What an amazing thing that would be. But you see, you need grace for that. And yet it will eventually bring you before great men. It'll open up other doors. It's an amazing thing what that can mean. Verse 17, the first one to plead his cause seems right till his neighbor comes and examines him. Now, like verse 13, answering a matter before you hear it, here is one that you see why a person wants to prejudge a situation. He's heard one side, and it seems right. Or here is the person who is actually pleading his own cause. It certainly seems right in his own eyes. You know, because our own interests touch our hearts deepest, right? The things that interest us are going to touch us the deepest. And we judge things oftentimes right or wrong depending on how they affect us. This sin is very, very hidden. You know, there are those who lie outright. With each new challenge of truth, they find some other lie to cover up their tracks. But there are those whose lies are so hidden deep in themselves, they can't even see it. And their case seems right. And they convince themselves they're right until they get cross-examined. I can relate this to a situation that happened to me. I was doing some drywall taping back when I was in California working in construction. No, I'm sorry, this was actually a situation after I moved out here and I got picked up the drywall trade again to support myself and then and before the church, you know, took off. And I was pretty good with what I did. I knew I was a good worker. I knew how to make nice flat seams, you know, and make the walls look really nice. I took pride in my work. Well, I was doing a taping job and I got called back on a job. The supervisor called my boss and said, "Get that guy out here. These seams are all bowed out and they're going to be horrible when they're painted. They're not flat." Well, I took offense at this. I told my boss, I said, "I'll be happy to go out there and show that guy a thing or two because I know my work and there's no way those seams are not flat. I've got a procedure," and I'm explaining my procedure to him, and I says, "It's impossible. It's impossible." So he says, "Well, why don't you go out and check it out?" So I said, "All right." So I went out there and I first got into it with the supervisor. I says, "I don't know what you're talking about. These seams are flat." And I took my drywall knife and I put it up against the seam and they were all bowed out. And I said, "These are bad." He goes, "That's what I was trying to say." I said, "I have no idea how they got this bad because this is not my work. Somebody must have added something to these, you know, and I'm trying." Well, that was ridiculous. The bottom line was, upon closer inspection, I looked at one of the knives I'd used, and it was flat because I kept them flat. I would hone them down all the time, but it was so thin from overuse that it was just very, very weak, and it couldn't keep that nice flat thing when you put it against the wall. So the seam was really bowed out. And I looked at that and I said, "Wow, here is a case," and this is why I remembered this. It was a case where in my mind, I was absolutely right. There is no way that they could be right. I am right. And yet I was wrong upon closer inspection. Now, can you account in your own life for times like that? You've been absolutely certain that you've been wrong. I think, judging from the chuckles, that you've had those situations. Well, here's the key for this. You know, this is the whole idea of being around people. There are checks and balances, especially with close friends who are honest enough to tell you something and to give you encouragement. And, you know, you might think everything is on the up and up. But I've learned to question my own motives at times. That's a healthy thing to do. Why am I doing this? Why am I feeling this way? Why am I experiencing this thought? What selfish motivation is there? Lord, search my heart. But if I've got friends around me that might be able to see things that I don't see. Notice verse 18. When all fails with a person's stubbornness, I like this in verse 18. Casting lots causes contentions to cease. It keeps the mighty apart. Casting lots. Little thing of chance. Throw the dice, draw straws, choose. In basketball, invariably, in any particular game, the ball's going to go out of bounds and there's going to be an argument as to who it went off. And someone's going to say, I didn't go off of me last. I didn't touch it. Well, I didn't touch it. So no one's going to admit who touched it last. So you could argue forever on these things, and some people do, but it's a very simple thing that we apply, is we just choose. All right, go ahead and choose. So one person will put out one finger or two fingers, another person will put out one finger or two fingers, and they'll say, okay, call it odd or even, and they'll go like this, even. Okay, it's your ball. Go ahead, you take it. That little thing stops a lot of fighting. And sometimes I think what's cool about it is it's you're allowing that simple act of chance to decide that which probably would just cause a lot of problems and contentions. You know, sometimes when you disagree with somebody about something, you can't agree, go this way or that way, and you're, well, all right, flip a coin. Let the coin decide. The problem is you just can't, in deferring your will, you can't say, okay, make it 2 out of 3 if it doesn't go your way. Or 3 out of 5, or 5 out of 7, you know. It's a strange way of determining justice, I know. But in many respects, it's practical. Because it just gives us an understanding there are certain times that we just can't agree. We can't come to a conclusion. Do you have any things that are going on right now, maybe with someone that you just don't see eye to eye, that you see it differently, that you're just not heads up with it? You know, flip for it or divide it or do something just to settle it. Don't let it be an ongoing thing. Because notice verse 19, a brother offended is harder to win than a strong city. And contentions are like the bars of a castle. How hard should we work at relationships? There are going to be challenges. Again, the friends we often will most likely want to choose are like those that are going to be most like us. If they won't give us any other challenge, we can just relax. But I think it's important to diversify the people you're around. Again, in our day of transportation, we have more options, but maybe we need to work harder at the relationships we have. You know, in fact, look at how society has changed. We've become much more private. It used to be homes were built with porches on them. That was the most prominent feature on a home. And people in the community, you know, you're going in the evening on a hot day, you're out on the porch, and you're meeting your neighbors, you're interacting. But now, where's the most prominent feature on the outside of the house is the deck, the back deck. So I don't want to have to be limited to my neighbors. I want to invite who I want over to my house, and we will be in private on our back deck. I mean, this illustrates to me this issue of not wanting to work through difficult situations. We don't like difficulties. We don't like problem people. We don't like problem issues. We just want it to be easy. And when we go in that road, we don't learn anything. Hey, but the thing of it is, a brother offended is hard to win. It's a hard thing. But how many of you have been offended by somebody in some situation in the last few months? Anyway, raise your hand. Come on. First service was more honest than you guys. I know there's a lot more. All right, now that's a lot of hands. And how many people have you offended in the last few months over something, okay? All right, good. I'm glad you're honest with that. This is a part of life. Why are we so surprised when it happens? Why? I can't believe they did that. I'm never going to speak to them again. You know? That's how we react so often. And it's true. They're hard to win in a city. Sometimes to get through that pride that's been hurt or that misunderstanding or that offense that's happened. But the fact is we all offend and we're all offended at some time or another. So the key to me is working at it. It's taking the time to work at it. Not giving up. If you can't let things go and overlook faults and accept others as they are, the offenses are going to come and go, but you're going to get more and more isolated because you're going to have fewer people that you're willing to work with. Takes work. A man's stomach shall be satisfied from the fruit of his mouth, and from the produce of his lips he shall be filled. You can make a difference with your words. You could be satisfied more deeply by not what you're taking into your stomach, but what's coming out of your mouth. You could be more deeply satisfied by how you can encourage, build up someone. In fact, verse 21 says, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. The difference you can make with somebody, or by not doing or saying or encouraging someone, what damage can be done by silence. You know, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And of course, verse 22 says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Now, if you think friendships require maintenance, marriage requires 10 times the maintenance. It does. And I'm not saying this in a negative thing. Here's a man who's found a good thing, but you know what? It hasn't just come easy. In that culture especially, it was not an easy thing to find a wife. First of all, as a man, you would have to earn enough to be able to build your house so that you could then afford to have a wife and bring a wife into your home. You had to prepare a place. That took years of saving and hard work. You know, imagine this for a moment. I mean, it's easy for us to get married and then we can get everything on credit. And we can get everything immediately. We get our house, we get everything, and then we work like slaves to keep that stuff up. But in that culture, they didn't have any creditors and stuff like that. I mean, you had to basically pay cash. You had to have it all owned. Now, can you imagine, guys, that you couldn't get married until you bought a home outright with cash? I'll tell you what, it would certainly increase the work ethic in this nation, I'll bet you. People would be working a lot harder these days if they had that motivation. But now here's a guy who's found a good wife. He's found a good wife. It's a good thing. He's obtained favor from the Lord. It's a blessing, and it certainly is. But it still requires some maintenance. You know, I've heard it said this, that a marriage is made in heaven, but we're responsible for the maintenance work on earth. You know, it's true. You get out of what you put in. And when you're willing to put it in, and we're going to talk a lot more about marriage later in the Proverbs, but just as a thought, it's like an investment of your time. When you look at marriage as to be easy on yourself, and you just get married now, and now you can just settle back and just relax because all the courting days are over. You don't have to try to pretend all these nice things. You can just be yourself. If that's your posture, you're going to have a rude awakening in the first year of your marriage. I want to warn you. You know what I'm talking about. You know, when you were dating her, you were so thoughtful and kind. And it was the little things that you did that just made her fall in love with you. And you know, when you put her in the car, you open the door and you get in, you tuck her dress in for her, you know, close it for her and then dance around the other side. And, you know, you were so sensitive. Now she's halfway in the car and you're halfway down the street. She's trying to get her balance, you know, to catch herself. Point is, you know what? Those who are lazy at relationships have so much trouble. They get so offended. They're so proudful. They're so caught up in themselves, and they just don't know why they're having such trouble. And of course, they say, it's my wife, you know, or it's my husband. No, maybe it's you. That's what we need to learn. The poor man, notice how this comes out in verse 23, how this fits together. The poor man uses entreaties, but the rich answers roughly. Now, in a very real setting, the poor man has to be very careful with his words and not offend someone and be very careful. But the rich man, he doesn't need to worry about what people think of him. He's just going to speak roughly. He doesn't care whether he gets that or not because he can get something else. Now, when you think about this, it's all about a person's perception of themselves. A person who thinks themselves so all that, they don't work that hard at relationships. You know, those people who don't think they're all that, who perceive themselves, you know, that they've got to work at relationships, they're going to work harder. They're going to be more thoughtful. They're going to be more careful. They're going to work hard to be what they should be. I think that's a great picture for how we need to see ourselves, because the Bible says that we need to esteem others more important than ourselves. That we should not do things out of selfish ambition or empty conceit, but that esteeming others better than ourselves, Philippians 2. That is a key for us, because if we see ourselves as above others, we're just going to offend others all around us. We're not going to work at relationships, and we're going to wonder why nobody likes us. Of course, if you have so much, you might even not even care. You can live your own life privately. You've isolated yourself, seeking your own desire. But the one who doesn't see themselves as better, who sees in every person value and worth and just a blessing from the Lord and wants to bless that person and encourage that person because he sees himself as a servant to all, as Jesus did. That's the key. Verse 24 ties this in. It says, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. Now, I made an error in the last service by mentioning only one other version goes different from this. Actually, there are quite a few. The King James Version holds to this, a man who has friends, but a lot of the other translators will put it like this. A man who has friends or many friends may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. A lot of the good commentators actually have felt that this a better translation is a man who has friends may come to ruin. I feel, however, that there is a key here about a man who has friends must himself be friendly. Though the word in the Hebrew is not normally translated this way, in the context, this might be a key for this because of the whole chapter. So I can go either way with this. Either way, the ultimate truth is here at the bottom. There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And that is the key. I think if there's a true principle, if you want to have friends, you're going to have to be friendly. And it's also a principle that you could use it the other way, that if you're spreading yourself out with many friends, then you're really not going to be much value to each other. You know, whether you're an extrovert and you're able to make a lot of friends easy, the challenge for you is to dig deeper and get stronger relationships and not be so shallow. And an extrovert is likely not to work that hard at a relationship because he can always make friends easy. Where an introvert, they have a hard time making friends, but they're going to work harder at the ones they get. And so, I mean, you might be thinking, oh, I've been disadvantaged because I'm just not outgoing. I always wish that myself. I wish I was more outgoing, more bold out in public and able just to do things. But hey, there's a blessing in both ways, and there's a weakness in both ways. But the ultimate line here is this last phrase, there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. You know, in the final analysis, our friendships are going to be judged in the commitment level that we have, which comes from that agape love, that it's a self-dying love. I want the best for someone else. It's a love that we don't have by nature, but it's a love that when it's there, it's a friend who sticks closer than a brother, no matter what. Now, of course, we see in this a very clear tie to Jesus, who gave all for us. But I want to encourage you with something. You know, I think we misunderstand the need for love in marriage and in friendships. That we think in terms of agape, that is, okay, I've just got to die to myself and give myself, you know, fully, even though it's just a tough situation that I'm in. Understand that that's the foundation. But that sweet phileo love is built upon that foundation. For example, it's like this. Because I'm committed to my wife, I am committed to be faithful to her, I'm committed for her best, I think of her, I want her to have, I mean, I want the best for her, I love her, it's a self-dying love. I want to deny myself for her benefit. That's the foundation upon which now we have the phileo love, which is that give and take, mutual love. Now, the world has a saying that marriage is 50-50. And in some respects, that's true. But that can only be true if the foundation is 100-100. See, the phileo love is 50-50. It's give and take. It's mutual. It's like I help and she helps and, you know, we work together. But that's on the foundation of unconditional commitment. We're committed to each other, no matter what. And then that makes us work more at the phileo love. Foundation love is agape. Phileo is what's built upon that. Here's a friend that sticks closer than the brother because there is a commitment love there. And now you've got the friendship that is built on that commitment. When you're safe in someone's commitment, it's a lot more easy to build a friendship than when you're not secure in that person's love. So it's a very good picture, but how you see it unfold, I think, is very important because it's a matter of Jesus. He's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. He is the epitome of love and commitment to us. But there's another dimension here that even goes further that I think is quite amazing. The Bible speaks about God's love for us as agape. He loves us. God so loved, agape, the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's what agape does. It gives. It's not thinking of anything for itself. It does not seek its own. In fact, 1 Corinthians 13, where it says, love is patient, love is kind, love doesn't envy, doesn't parade itself about, is not puffed up. If you want to know where you are in that quality, just put your own name in there. John is patient. John is kind. John doesn't envy. John doesn't parade himself. John doesn't behave rudely or seek his own way. Sometimes that's a difficult one. Lloyd is patient. Lloyd is kind. Okay, I don't know. My wife would take argument with that one. But you could put Jesus here. Jesus is patient. Jesus is kind. Jesus doesn't envy. He is the epitome of that committed love. God loves us. He gave himself for us. But he also said something to his disciples in John 15. He says, you are my friends if you do whatever I command you. See, now we're talking about a mutual give and take thing, where I'm in obedience to the Lord, and there's that mutual, you know, enjoyment of fellowship with him. God loves you. That's the foundation. That's the agape upon which the phileo, friendship love, is built with God. As I know he's committed to me, I'm yielded to him. And I enjoy that friendship with God, that fellowship with him. But if I'm not in obedience, I'm not going to enjoy that fellowship. I'm not going to enjoy that friendship love. Oh, he still loves me. The agape, the foundation is there. But he might love me enough to discipline me if I need it, if I'm going in the wrong direction. But I'm not enjoying that sweet fellowship. Friend loves at all times. Man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Certainly, the Lord has given us an example of how we should be in our relationships.